bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Ader Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
Brian Brushwood.
All too brief our time together will be, because I have to run off to an appointment, but I'm glad to be here for the beginning.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. That's me.
We are now on Raise the Dead Eve.
Yeah. Wait, would that be the Eve of Apocalypse or... Day of the Dead Eve, which would
Eve of the Dead. Wait, no, that's Halloween. Is
yeah.
it Halloween again?
All
Andrew,
Hallows
are we doing Halloween
Eve.
Again?
Yeah.
No. I'm talking about Justin's new podcast launching tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
Or by the time you listen to this.
Yeah. New show coming out called Raise the Dead. I'm very excited for people to listen to it. The first episode will go live tomorrow, hopefully on all major podcast platforms. But you will be able to hear the first episode, which features the beginnings of why Raise the Dead exists, the similarities between the 1960 election and the 2016 election, and kind of the beginning of where this first story, the 1960 story, starts. And that is at the 1956 convention, the moment that JFK becomes a star and everything that led up to that moment, which includes a harrowing trip to deal a vital blow to Hitler during World War II and how it affected the shape of our nation.
Very cool. I think our listeners are going to absolutely love this, the amount of history that Justin's packed in here. And I mean, just it's all relevant, all ties together. Reminded me of there was a show I used to love was James Burke did called Connections.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Where, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So he would talk about something like the automobile and talk about how the perfume industry led to the carburetor and this and all these sort of connections to that. And I think this is a kind of like a politics and not a conspiracy theory thing, but literally like what changed, what happened? He starts from, hey, this thing happened back then. What changed to this 1960 election? How did that change things now? How do we feel the repercussions of the way things are sort of done today? But just how much of history was impacted by things, sometimes decisions made in a back room in the middle of nowhere, sometimes by people who were well known, in that day, but like now in history books, they've become minor figures, but they were actually kind of kingmakers to an extent. And just the way politics was done back then, Justin, that's one of the things I really appreciated was just how effing dirty it was.
Well, yeah. And that's the thing is that for everything that we can say about our modern system right now, it's without question the most free and fair that it's ever been. And 1960 is a big reason why, because prior to 1960, nobody had seriously spent money, time, and effort and rolled the dice on a promising young campaign on the idea of running in the primaries. And it was designed to be a death trap by the parties. And now that exists. So it's like if you look at the problems that we're dealing with now, on like, oh, where are people advertising and are they micro-targeting? Are foreign governments interfering? All that stuff is built on top of the idea that candidates go and directly market themselves to the people as opposed to how it was before, which is make your connections in Washington. You could effectively run for president by only going to steakhouses in Washington. Like that. You could run your entire campaign out of the back of steakhouses in D.C.
If you're listening early or just want to get a taste at some of the stuff Justin's talking about, we did like a 20-plus minute episode of The Modern Rogue, How to Steal an Election 1960, that man, oh, man, when you get to the end conclusion that compared to just in 1960, like our parents remember this election, and when you find out just how corrupt everything was, to the statement that you can authentically say that elections are the fairest, among the fairest that they've been in the entire history of our country. Man, oh man, do people not want to hear those words? Do they freak out in the comments? Like, they just reject the thesis out of hand, and no amount of hearing those stories seems to stop them from wanting to stick to their guns. That are like, no, everything's more fraudulent now.
Well, I mean, and you can say that they're, you always have to chase the fraud around, right? There's no point in any history, in any system, where there was fraud existing that then it's like, ah, we did it. We beat it. Fraud's never going to deal with us again, especially when you're dealing with something as powerful as the presidency of the United States. Way later in the series, literally the final episode opens with this awesome passage from the book Making of the President, which was historic in its own right. But I wanted to include it because it had this just beautiful retelling of what an election is and how an election happens in America. And it has just this great moment where it just dunks on every other democracy in the world about, like, just the American exceptionalism of the idea that no country dares to actually put in a leader the way we put in a leader. That just puts, like, not parliamentarian. It's just a direct vote by the people through the Electoral Congress. And then we get a person that has that much power. And the real big kicker to there is that he goes, there's only been one major nation in history that has tried such a model. It was the Weimar Republic in Germany, based on the American system, and they got Hitler. And that's the thing. It's like, this is a... It's the most powerful person on the planet for a reason. And man, back then, it was interesting and it changed a lot. And then, you know, as I hope to explain to everybody in the show, there are lessons there that are not only, I mean, there are conventions that are started in 1960, including that 1956 convention that are still used today that, you know, was a part of the origin story for another major president, but also, you know, it is my opinion that elements of the Donald Trump campaign were very specifically trying to run the Kennedy campaign from 1960 to get their man elected in the White House. And it worked. And yet nobody's really pointed that out until me.
So just so everyone knows the battle plan, of course, if you're able to subscribe, hopefully everything will be approved on the Apple platform. Of course, everyone subscribe tomorrow, Tuesday, the 3rd, and get a friend too, because say, hey, man, I'm listening to this. You should do it too. And I've noticed that people are pretty fast and easy to hit that subscribe button because they always know they don't have to listen to it. And it's not like it's going to, you know, they can always unsubscribe later. And meanwhile, as far as I could tell, nobody tracks unsubscribes. And so if you can get people to subscribe, there's a huge difference between 50 and 150 subscriptions per hour to the tune of hitting the top 10, possibly the number one spot on the iTunes charts.
And this, I made this and I'm releasing it at this time specifically because this is when podcasts start to take weeks off or start to do best of shows. We all just went through one of them gulches, right? Like, we all just went through a big holiday season from Thursday through Sunday. Nobody's releasing shows, right? This is the perfect time to get into a project like this. And I'm so excited for people to listen to it. So far, I've heard just great, great feedback, including comparisons to shows that I revere as kind of the top of the art. So it's been awesome to hear people react to the preview. If you already listened to the preview, please obviously subscribe and download the first episode, because what you're going to get at the end of it is not only, along with the credits, a lot of stuff that I wasn't able to fit into the episode. So I got another like 10 minutes of odds and ends that just didn't, I couldn't find a place to do it, but are well worth talking about. So you're going to want to get that. And there might be another little extra thing in there.
It's actually a pretty good, I wonder if I wonder if there's a place for that on an ongoing basis for each episode, like just brickbats, that sort of your letter from the editor at the end of each episode.
Brian, I think that's a great idea, and I'm going to put it into every episode.
Yay!
Where should people go to so that they know they have all the right stuff?
RaiseTheDeadPodcast.com is where you're going to need to go. That will have the RSS feed on it, and the iTunes link and the Google Play link and Spotify, everywhere that you need to be. Just head on over to Raise the Dead Podcast. And then eventually, I had to put off. I wanted to launch day and date with the ebook and the audiobook, but considering my tardiness submitting these things might have already screwed up my launch, I'm glad that I gave myself another week. So it'll be another week or two before I get the ebook and an audiobook ready to go. But at that point, you'll be able to listen to or read the transcripts for everything, including a bonus episode that delves far more into the criminality and the Chicago mob, Frank Sinatra, that surrounds the idea that the 1960 election was meddled with by way of nefarious means. Another comparison to the 2016 campaign is that the losing side was very upset and was very, very sure that this very close election was tipped by nefarious means. In 1960, it's the Chicago mob.
I'm very, very excited to see what happens with this, and I hope we get to see more stuff like this. Mm-hmm. I have a suggestion for the next one, because I know you're ready for ideas for your next podcast series.
I actually have an idea, but and this might be Brian's not going to be here for After Things, but go ahead, and then I'll pitch you guys my dilemma for season two.
Well, I don't know if you saw the news, but apparently Washington, D.C. was in shutdown a few days ago because of a UFO attack.
Oh, that very natural season two. No. I've not been aware of that.
So there was an alert in D.C. I got to forget how many days ago it was. And they actually had had orange alert. And, you know, people noticed some missile defense systems seemed to be swiveling around and active, and there was a lot of activity, and I think they shut down parts of the area because they had some very weird things show up on radar, on the satellite, as they're looking at the radar, and there was, you know, some unknown thing appeared to be in the area, a blob, as it's called. And there was some big, you know, discussion. What is this? What's going on? I don't think they had any sightings of this, but it was enough of a surprise for them to actually go to orange alert on that. And speculation now is,
well, I mean, I would imagine you'd be afraid of like a swarm of drones or something that would show up as a cloud on radar, but these are eyewitness accounts or what it looked like on radar.
This was just radar. This was radar says, hey, there's this large form of something, you know, in the area.
Could it have been like a weather phenomena?
I would go with just a massive cloud of birds, like just an unbelievable swarm of starlings or something.
Brian, that's the dumbest thing anybody ever said. So,
yeah, for CNN, slow moving blob that might have been a flock of birds caused White House lockdown. Wow. This is not the first time we've seen a big flock of birds show up on radar, right? I remember. Was it earlier this year or maybe last year? We had a very similar story, but not in Washington, D.C. And that was just the same thing. It was just so many birds at once, it started showing up on radar.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, tell you what, these birds, man, when are they going to learn? They're going to get shot down. I mean, what are they doing flying around? Yeah, this is the government. Someone get in these birds' ear and just let them know that. Stop the malarkey.
Well, one of the sites that covered this, which I thought was kind of interesting, is they showed somebody took a photo because they looked up and they noticed what was a missile defense system that's on one of the roofs of a house that's near right in front of the White House. And kind of the realization of like, oh, yeah, there's missile batteries and all sorts of stuff. Like, it feels like it's a national park. But guess what? You're in the middle of an extremely militarized, you know, dome of all sorts of technologies and countermeasures.
God, that would be something that, like, obviously we can't know, but to know, like, all right, DC empties the clip. Like, what does that look like? What does, like, DC on full defensive alert look like? That's a fascinating idea. Like, let's say it's under attack tomorrow. The firepower on the capital of our nation.
God. You've heard
about, like, you know, the White House driveway has a pit underneath it, right? So basically it only handles a certain amount of weight, and anything over that weight, if it drives through, it falls through. So,
oh wow.
So
if, like, a tank rolls up, it collapses.
Exactly. So if you make it through the metal barriers and the gates and all that, then it'll collapse through there. That's one of the things that's there. There's, you know, they did renovations. A couple times they've done renovations where they've extended, like, they've created more sub-basements and stuff. You know, everybody knows about the tunnel that goes to the Treasury, like, or to the, you know, the Treasury, because that was, like, back in World War II, where they'd wheel Roosevelt through there on his, you know, to go to sleep at night in case, you know, the Germans managed to get a bunch of fighter planes through and tried to bomb D.C. So if the White House got taken out, which, hey, the British did, by the way, thanks, jerks, you know, way before then. There's that. There's, I had a friend that worked in a news bureau in DC, and he talked about how they had a satellite map of the DC area with infrared imaging, right? Like, it was an infrared map. And he said, you could see, there was this long line that you could see a line that ran from the White House to the Fed, you know, to the Federal Reserve. And he said, there was another line that ran all the way to the Air Force Base, the closest Air Force Base.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And you would think, like we talk a lot about drones on this show, but drones are so public and so loud and so visible. They're probably not even up for consideration in terms of even observation, you know? A camera is so much quieter and indefinite.
They have a lot of, like, that's part of things, a lot of countermeasures too now. Like, there, we've talked this before, like anti-drone stuff like this. There's a lot of other stuff that's probably used there, you know, and you have to figure out, like, they probably do assessments of, like, payloads to figure out, like, how much damage is a drone going to do versus a missile or something else. You know, if you looked at the president's limousine, by the way, if you've noticed this thing, if you look at how thick the glass is on that, it's insane. It's like, it's just, you know, that thing is designed to be able to take basically, you know, it's bazooka blasts and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, it's beyond bulletproof. So, like, the countermeasures in there are, one is you have this impact resistant glass, you have an air system and all that's the design, so it can completely be sealed off from the outside, whatever there. So people try to use poison gas on it. If you try to throw grenades or whatever kind of stuff like this, this is an armored vehicle disguised to look like a limousine.
Yeah.
And inside there, there's the last measure, which is supposed to be like an Uzi that's there that the president has access to if people make it all the way through all their perimeters of security.
I'm just imagining.
One of the things that they do for the...
No, I'm just imagining all of the like fan art of Trump wielding a Uzi off of a flaming motor carriage.
Well, that's one of the things that they do when you get elected is that you spend a couple, you know, parts of your day, not like, I don't know how, if it's like several days, but you spend part of your time going through a weapons training with the Secret Service because they make sure that, you know, last line of defense, that you know what to do. But yeah, in the DC area too, I wrote about this in Blackfall because this is, and I didn't get too into specifics because I don't want to reveal stuff. I don't know if it's supposed to be revealed, but like some of the buildings in front of the White House aren't like, they're fake. They're like fake organizations and stuff, and basically there are exits that lead from the White House to there. So if you want to have somebody come and go from the White House, they can go in. I've had a friend that actually did that. You know, he needed to go to, he was there and had to go to the hospital for some reason, and they took him through a tunnel and took him out of a building that was across the street.
Wow.
That's
yeah.
I mean, I guess so. That is the thing is we are obviously a very stable democracy and a world power at this point, but we were also a, you know, separatist republic that has had our fair share of wars at the outset and a massive military that is going to make sure that the homeland is protected. So man, this kind of stuff is endlessly fascinating to me. And really, yeah. It would be like, you know, the closest that we saw, I mean, the closest that we would have seen to any of this, right, would have been 9/11, if that if that fourth plane hadn't gone down in Pennsylvania as it was allegedly headed to Washington. Like, we would have seen like the full power of the American military trying to defend itself within its own borders, which we had certainly not seen in a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and also, like, what's interesting is, you know, the plane that hit the Pentagon, and part of the conspiracy theories were the fact that how little damage it appeared to do, you know, and there was sufficient, tremendous damage done to it, actually, but still, it was built so strongly and securely that that's why people had, they had expected it, like, if it had struck a commercial building or something else, that it would have, you know, had a much greater impact, you know, and again, it, if you read in the reports, you find out it did way more, but because of the construction of it, it was able to minimize that damage to one sort of part of it. And also the Pentagon's really huge, really huge.
Well, it's gigantic. B, isn't it like a Pentagon because that is a more secure structure? Like, it is supposed to be this unbustable barnacle on the DC landscape.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, yeah, precisely.
Wow.
So, anyhow, so that's kind of weird things pop up. But yeah, probably a flock of birds. But nonetheless, people got a little bit of a glimpse into some of the security all around the White House. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's the things you're supposed to see and then the things you don't see. You know, and we've talked about like airport security and stuff like that. And it's like, well, there are the things we're supposed to see, which may not be effective in reality, and the things we don't see. Not assuming that it's all effective, but some of it is, but, you know, systems that don't get tested, you never know. Yeah. Hey, speaking of systems, get tested all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the weird thing system. You got to keep it flowing. Got to keep it going.
Yeah. That's why you head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings here, folks. Hi, it's me, Justin Robert Young. I know that you go through your life saying, well, the Weird Things podcast is my favorite thing I listen to every week. I would love it if, especially during the holiday season, I were able to show my gratitude. Well, how about you consider doing this, friends? Head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. Support the show there. And then you get the After Things podcast faster than anybody else. And you get to know this holiday season that you are bringing a smile and continuing the flow of weird to the Weird Things show. patreon.com/weird.
The weird must flow. Is what we say.
It must.
So I want to talk, if I may, briefly about what I did this weekend.
Sure. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I mean, if it's anything like what I did this weekend, right? I went and had some good food with my friends. I, you know, sat back, enjoyed the holiday a little bit, really kind of took in all the things in my life. Really, really a real Thanksgiving, really giving my thanks, you know? I'm sure Justin had a very similar, I'm sure we all three of us had a very similar weekend. Yeah.
It was a little bit of a catch up weekend. Did a bunch of you know, prep for the Raise the Dead podcast. Mm-hmm. Submitted my feed too late. You know, there's just a lot of things that that happened. But Andrew, I suspect you also took it easy, right?
I'd say after about Saturday afternoon, you know, then I just took it real easy, slept for a long time, and then, you know, sort of relaxed on Sunday and went for a nice long walk last night.
So wait a minute, what happened before Saturday?
Well, I decided I was going to try to do NaNoWriMo, National Write a Book Month. I said, you know, every year I tell myself I should participate in this. I should support other people writing because I'm a big fan of people expressing themselves through the written word. And I'm like, man, I need to do this. I should really try to do the, you know, write a book in a month, you know, NaNoWriMo. And it turns out NaNoWriMo is for the month of November.
Well, and now, and correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew, but it's actually December now. It's only December 2nd now, so that would have made Saturday. So today's the 2nd. Sunday would have been the 1st, so Saturday really would have been the only day. Now, people plan for NaNoWriMo. They kind of, you know, they get ahead of it. They spend more than the month. Frankly, they spend more than the month, and I think that's illegal.
I thought about this on Friday. So on Friday, okay. So I had like a day and a half left, and I'm like, a day and a half.
Now, that doesn't seem like enough time to maybe write an entire book, I think.
You know, I thought the same thing, and you're right. I actually sat down and I measured my typing speed and I put it into a spreadsheet, and I found out there is no way in hell in the next 24 hours I'm going to be able to write a 50,000 word book. I said, that is just not going to happen. So this is a stupid goal, and I should give it up and think of something more practical to do.
So wait a minute. Then that's it? That was the end of it? You just gave up? That was a wrap?
That's it.
Ups given.
Well, I mean, then I said, hey, I've been meaning to work on dictation. I wonder, and there's like Google had this kind of fun real-time Google recorder dictation app where you could, you know, as you speak, it does a live transcription with punctuation. And I said, you know, that's cool. And I'd ordered a Pixel phone to play around with that. And I'm like, huh, I wonder if I could just try to use dictation to do this, because this would be, I've always found myself limited when I do dictation. I never do it for more than 20 or 30 minutes because my voice starts to get a little bit sore. I'm like, what if I drink lots of water? What if I don't let my voice get sore? And let me see if I could, what I could do then. So, long story short, what I did Friday afternoon, I went to lunch with a friend at the Magic Castle, and I was telling him about, like, yeah, I thought it'd be kind of fun to try to write a novel in 24 hours. But I think it's kind of a dumb idea. But he's like, ah, it's a cool idea. And Justin had said, like, you should do it. And I'm like, yeah, I guess so. But I was so worried about failing, so I didn't want to come right out and say, hey, everybody, I'm going to try to do this. But once I played with the dictation part, I realized that if I have to create, like, when you talk about writing speeds to people, they go like, oh, you know, my mom's a, you know, typist. She can type 300 words per minute. I'm like, that's great. That's not the same as inventing a story, you know, inventing a story and writing it. It's not a matter of how fast you type. It's partially that. But I found that, like, my best writing speed probably for that's like 2,500 words per hour. But if I do it like 3 or 4 hours in, I get like 1,500 words per hour. The after time, I get tired. And I did the math to look at, like, well, there are 24 hours in a day, which means I have to be doing at least, you know, 2,100 words per hour. And I'm like, yes, I could do that in peak. But if I haven't slept in 24 hours, I won't be able to do that.
And that's assuming you know everything that you're going to type, too.
Exactly, Bryce. And that's not really a lot of time to stop and think about what you're doing or use the bathroom. So I thought, like, what if I play with this app and just let me just see how many words I could record in an hour. And I open up the app. I thought up like an idea for a scene and I just dictated it. And then at the end of it, it turned out that the average was like 9,000 words per hour using dictation.
Wow. Now, and if and just to remind everyone, you're trying to get to 50,000 words an hour, or 50,000 words total.
So you have to get to 50,000 words. So if you just said, you know, hey, I'm going to plan, half the time is going to be, I'll spend 30 minutes planning what I write and 30 minutes dictating it. You know, that meant that, like, in roughly, you know, 10 or 12 hours, you could theoretically write a 50,000 word novel.
Wow.
Huh. So.
And how was that experience? Because I know when I've done, like just over on this past Friday, I streamed some games here on the Twitch channel, and I was playing this one game, and it's very text heavy, and there's not a lot of voiceover. So I spent like two blocks of 2 hours each, just reading this game just nonstop. And I know at the end of that, anytime I had to do a lot of reading on stream, my throat, I mean, very seriously gets like hurt, you know, even when you try to hydrate. So how do you deal with that?
I mean, my voice is a little raspy, but I just super hydrated. I actually ended up sitting in my car to do it because I was kind of self-conscious, like reading aloud, you know, and dictating aloud in front of my girlfriend, even though she had her headphones in and could care less, but it just felt kind of weird. So I actually went and sat in my car, and I just had a bunch of water bottles, and I would just be just constantly drinking water. So it would, like, I would go do 2 or 3 chapters in a session, and then I would go inside, go work on my chapters, and use the restroom, to be honest with everybody, because I was just, so much water was running through me. But that was the key, was just kept drinking water. And so, you know, I finished, I don't know the phone here, but I finished and I had like, the total was about 6 hours of narration time, you know, what it came out to be.
Okay.
And it ended up being like 52,000 words. So it was about 6 hours of talking nonstop. But because of that really, really super hydrating, that made all the difference in the world. So I guess my point of this was I wanted to see for myself what would happen, and I wanted to learn from it. I can go a little bit more into it in NaNoWriMo about what I did here rather in After Things or whatever. But I just wanted to share with everybody because I am kind of – I'm proud of myself because, like, I didn't know if I could do it, and then I did it, and then the book's not going to be too good.
Well, all right, hold on. Before we get there, let's focus on the effort, because I think the lesson here is just going and doing a thing, right? Like, that's the key here. That's the spirit of NaNoWriMo. You obviously are a professional published author, so the idea of stretching your ability to do something is, I think, important. And that was a super rad idea, and that's why I was encouraging you to do it and to talk to people about it, because I don't think that there is a failure point on something like that. Like, if you try to do a thing and then you don't, it's like, oh, yeah, you weren't able to write a novel in a day. That would be about what anybody would expect. If the failure point is, yeah, I took 2 days to write a novel, it's not going to be the biggest thing in the world.
2 days, Justin. I need my novels every single day. I can't wait what is this, Amazon Prime shipping? I can't wait 2 days.
90s? I mean, I think that I think it was advantageous for you to try if you were willing to put in the time and effort, which obviously you were. The other side of it is, even a failure would have been such a great lesson.
That was the thing, is about, after I sat down and I did my first session where I sat in my car and I think I recorded maybe three or four chapters. And I went and I checked the word count and it was 10,000 words, and less than 2 hours had elapsed.
Yeah.
That was like, to me, that was like, cause I did a blog post about this, where I've gone into all the details because it's helpful for me. I think it'll be helpful for other people. Like, these are all the things I learned doing this. And I just figuring out that I could do 10,000 words in just a little over an hour was like kind of mind blowing, because theoretically you knew that you could tell that would be possible. But then for me to do that, I was like, holy cow, this is going to have a big impact on how I write. Not that all my books are going to be dictated from now on, but it was surprising. It was just that really big moment. And then when I hit, 20,000 words or something like that, like 5 hours later, or I forget how many, like just 5 hours later, like, oh, I'm going to try this around, 7 o'clock when I started writing. I hit midnight, little after midnight, or a couple hours after midnight, I was already halfway there and I wasn't tired. That was like this holy cow. And then there was the point at which I went to bed at like 5 a.m. because I'd hit 40,000 words, and I'm like, I still have, 12 more hours to write the rest. And it was just a lot of moments of going, this is what's possible. And
so let me ask this in terms of how you would apply a strategy like this to your current workflow. If you are at a point where, writer's block is something that I think means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But let's say you are in a rut on where to go with a story or the specific characters, the decisions that they would make that would fit what you want to do. Is this something where now you feel comfortable that it's like, okay, well, let me just dictate three different ideas and I'll just take a look at them and go forward. Is that something that you might use it for going in the future?
I could certainly see where that could be helpful if you wanted to do dialogue. If let's say you're at a scene, you don't know what the characters need to say to each other, and you want to sort of freeform just say out loud, they say this, the other person says that. But the thing that was actually, it was almost kind of inverse for me, was that I consider outlining one of my secret strengths. It's one of the things I tell people, is like, a really good outline is not like, oh, just a summary. It's about structure. It's really about just getting to the structure of the story. And if your outline is structurally sound and you faithfully execute it, you'll be in pretty good shape. When I talk to people whose stories meander and don't go anywhere, I find out they had a description of what happens, but they didn't have their outline had no structure. There was no structure to, like, there's a reversal here, there's a setup here, there's this here, that. So I've always been good. Not always. I mean, I had to learn to be good at doing structure. Like, my structure, I think, is one of the strongest points in some of my books, and that my characters. But when I sat down to do this, I realized that a lot of times I sit down to write a chapter, I spend a lot of time, I'll have to spend a lot of time to think about what I didn't put in my notes. And I've sort of realized, like, I've been omitting certain things and inventing them on the spot, that when you have to go write something 50,000 words in 24 hours, you're very apparent of like, yeah, I don't have an hour to go for a walk and think about this. I've got to do this right now. And when I sat down to write my outline, I didn't think about this important point. And normally I think about a chapter breakdowns with a conflict and a resolution. Every chapter exists because there's a part of the conflict and what's the resolution. And then when doing this, I said, I need to be very clear about what my character is doing in this. And it sounds obvious, but it literally is like, is my character trying to find information out? And these are, and yes, these are basic writing points that I would have explained before, but to understand the emphasis of how much when you sit down to like dictate and say something like, what's their work? What is their work right now? You know, is this person at a party trying to talk to people because he wants to meet a girl? You know, is this person in a warehouse trying to find a place to hide? And I have to, I say, I got to get really specific and say, you know, it's like in a, I talk about like procedural TV shows. What do the people do? You know, you can have a premise, but you say, okay, scene 12, what is the person doing right there? You know, are things happening to them or are they an agent of change? So
mm-hmm. Very cool.
That was a big point.
And so that is something where kind of like rapid prototyping can help. Like
yep.
just the ability of putting it together, seeing how it looks and kind of rapidly evaluating it as opposed to, because I do think that there is something to like effort when you put craft into something. And it is a second level lesson that I've had to learn in as I put together stuff that is expected to be a lot more polished than, let's say, a live tape podcast, is that you wind up becoming I guess it is like the sunk cost fallacy, where you feel like very protective of the thing because you know the work that went in, and what you've given yourself in this experiment is the idea to just be like, all right, well, idea, cool. Like, let me just look at the idea. Let me give it a once over, and then we can go forward and put more effort into it past that. But that's so important sometimes, that just to divorce the concept from what we in our eight brains understand as like, oh no, this is worthwhile because yeah. I sweat on it and I took time to do it and I made sure that it was punctuated correctly, and therefore it is worth a thing that maybe, you know, for the creative process, there's a reason why so many of the most important lessons are kill your darlings, not because there's a inherent idea that we never want to part with things that we like, but because very often they're the things that we created. Like, and so it does take the best critical eyes are the ones that are like, eh, but can it work without it? Not that it's good, not that it's bad. Can it work without it? And you've given yourself an ability to kind of X-ray that, which is rad.
Yeah, there's... I got over, you saw me kind of get over the sunk cost fallacy with writing when I first started, you know, when I just said, I'm going to just write a ton of books, some I'll release, some I won't, but every one of them will be a learning experience. And that's how I feel now, is that like everything I'm going to do, I'm going to learn from, and I'll write a book and be like, well, why don't you do something with it? Like, I did, I wrote it. I had the experience of writing it. It's like, I don't, you know, if you're a musician, you don't record every practice session.
Yeah.
You know, and then put it on Spotify. You just do it for yourself. And then when you feel like, oh, no, this is good, I'm going to develop this more, I'm going to take it out there. And that's one of the things I encourage a lot of writers to think about, is that not every word is precious. And you might have something good, but maybe it's not quite there, but you can take those elements to it. And once you get in the habit of just doing it over and over and over again, and you're not afraid. And for me, psychologically, knowing that, like, oh yeah, I can write an entire novel in a day. And I looked at the, I did the time. I looked at this. I said, if I wanted to hit an 80,000 word mark, which was like what your commercial fiction is generally, I could have done that, you know? And that realization for me says, okay, don't be too precious, you yeah. know, just don't be too precious just because you can, but plan. And it really made me think more about outlining.
Yeah. Just one more button on that. I do think that no matter what, the big lesson here is you will always learn more about your craft the more you do it,
yep.
no matter how you do it, no matter what element that you're doing it, there's always something to learn, and it can always make the full project better going forward. And so, yeah, like for your example here, Andrew, you got, no matter what, a absolute hands-on lesson on how much outlining, you know, the finer points of outlining where you're going to run into problems if you go really, really, really fast, and how to just go really yeah. fast, which helps.
Yeah. And in your description as an X-ray was great, because it's like, I've you know, I, when I talk to other writers and stuff, you know, I get complimented on, you know, the quality of my outlining and the way I'm able to go into that and do that. But this show, I still had a lot to learn. And that's what I like. That's kind of exciting about it, is to know as a writer is there's other ways to make things better. I've been very lucky, you know, I've been very lucky with my writing career, but I'm excited about the idea of like, oh, wow, here's some other things I can do to improve the quality. I don't have all the answers. And that's very rewarding and weird because, you know, you want people, once you get over the idea, I need to know everything how to do it, and you realize, man, this is a journey. And, you know, I find that kind of, you know, exciting, the idea that like, ah, I found some other thing that I can do about the process. For anybody out there, you know, the thing I want to tell people, if you're thinking about writing, is 10 years ago, I'd never written a novel. 10 years ago, I have never written anything more than 30,000 words. And those 30,000 words was as far as I got into a novel before I gave up and didn't know what to do. I did not know if I was capable of writing novels 10 years ago. It was something that I thought, maybe I just don't have the attention span. I came up with excuses and said, nah, I'm just a guy that has to do shorter projects or this. That's who I am. And then one day I said, that's BS. I'm going to be who I want to be. And if it's physically possible, then let me try to do that. And, you know, if you went topped into a time machine and told me 10 years ago, like, hey, guess what? One day you're going to write an entire novel in a day. It won't be a very good novel, but you'll be able to do that. I would, you know, be skeptical, but excited about the prospect. And anybody wants to write, you know, writing speed doesn't matter. I make that clear. Is like, I put the thing in my blog post about this is, first thing I put in there is the quote from Chris Rock. You can drive a car with your feet if you want to. It doesn't mean it's a good effing idea. And, you know, and I wanted to make this very clear, like writing fast was just as kind of an exercise, sort of a musical scale kind of thing. But I think for other people to find different techniques, to find a way that you can write, don't be afraid. You can do it.
Dead Polymers here in the chat says meandering and directionless. That's everything I've ever written. Congratulations. Yeah. You are already 50% of the way to where you want to go. Like, yeah. That was the biggest turning point for me in terms of Raise the Dead going from something that I was perpetually working on to something that I had to put out, is once I put a deadline on myself, I realized real quick what my process was. I identified the weaknesses in my process really fast. And I went from really editing the transcript to just reading the transcript in an overly long, minor audio cues way, and then saying, okay, here's a pile of crap. How do I make this pile of crap good? What's good here? What's bad here? What needs to be cut? What needs to be emphasized? Then going back, doing more research, building on the initial points, realizing what the story kind of wanted to be. Iteration is it in anything creative. Write sloppy. Write real sloppy. As long as you're writing, man, like developing the keen eye to go and refine is just crucial.
And I think it's interesting that both of your projects have an element of both of you, what, for Justin being the final product, for Andrew being the initial fodder, of saying aloud whatever it is that that you're writing. And mm-hmm. and that gives you a different perspective on like if you can write for, you know, a scientific paper, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to sound good when someone hears it, or if there's an audiobook version, or if it's going to be even easy to read. And so having that verbal element helps out a lot. I mean, I do a little segment on Chord Killers, and occasionally I will write that segment for myself if we don't get an email in, and I have to like write how I know I'm going to speak, because in the moment it doesn't matter what I wrote down, it matters what I say. And it's easier for mm-hmm. it's better for me in this utility sense to write how I'm going to speak, so that I don't get off, you know, off on a tangent, so that I don't lose my place. And I'm sure the opposite is the same for both of you, so that you can start in a very casual place and then go into how proper, how scripted, how unscripted, how literary, how verbal you want it mm-hmm. to sound after the fact.
You know, and that's a very good point, Bryce. Changing something from one medium to another is a great way to see what carries over or what doesn't. And, you know, I've talked a bit before, you know, the project I've been spending most of my time on is Audiomatic, my platform for turning any kind of text into audiobooks or podcasts with multiple voices and stuff. And one of the features I put in there, sort of an afterthought, is if you scroll down too, you'll see the little GIFs that I put there to sort of show the thing in progress. One of the things I've added is simple, and it's something that's available in a lot of word processing apps. Is just there, if you look on the below that button there, you see there's a little robot. You click on that, and that reads it back to you using just your regular computer voice and not the special voices. And that's what I use for proofreading. And I was telling Justin, like, yeah, the thing that I'm going to do now when I need to edit my books is after I've done, gone through it to polish, I'm just going to have the robot read it back to me so I hear it aloud. And hearing something aloud, both saying, dictating the book makes you think about the way I used words differently than I would write. And then hearing something aloud makes things stand out. Really, you notice the mistake, or you notice like things just pop for you and the awkwardness, the way something sounds. So, mm-hmm. You know, I encourage people to think about that. Like, you know, if it's something you want to write, think about saying it. If it's something you want to say, think about writing it first, you know, and then if it's something you want to share with everybody else, hear it. Just quick technical answers. We had a question in the chat room was about what services I used. I used Google Recorder initially, which what that does is it records your voice. It makes a little M4A recording, and it also does a transcript. And then you can just press a button and upload that to Google Drive, which is great. So you have backups for that. And then the transcription on it was good, not great. And then I did an import over it into Otter AI, OTTER.AI. You guys familiar with this?
No.
Otter is wonderful. Otter is really good. I've played with them before for doing some like podcast stuff and all that, but Otter is a really inexpensive machine translation service. Like their free tier is 600 minutes a month, but if you go to their paid tier, which is like 10 bucks, it's only like 10 bucks a month, right? It's because you 6,000 minutes. So what they do is their transcription's pretty well. It does speaker diarization, so it'll recognize different speakers. So if we wanted to do transcripts of this podcast, we could tell them which you could highlight and say, this is Justin speaking, this is Bryce speaking, this is Andrew speaking. Mm-hmm. And it'll go back and reformat your transcript with everybody's the proper voices for each one. I found the quality of it was really good. And so I'm working on trying to figure out a workflow to maybe probably just use Otter AI for transcription.
Yeah, you know, I've actually seen a few different services that'll do that. In a similar, some that have been geared for podcasting and some that are geared for other things. But like I have not heard of Otter specifically, but I have heard of a few others that you have to, I don't know that it's live audio recording, but you do give it an audio source. Maybe some of them do recording, but there's kind of a wide open field now of this.
A lot of them are built on top of Google's, speech to text platform, which has built in speech. Some of them are built into, you just use that. Like that's a thing that I've become aware of is like, oh, we offer the service. I'm like, yeah, your API is you just plug it into Google. Where Otter, I think, is using some of its own stuff because its translations appear to be better and has sort of a better quality. But the thing about Otter is it's cheap, like 6,000 minutes a month for like 10 bucks. And there are existing human services that I don't think are any better that are way more expensive. Like I used to use, I don't want to name other services, but I used to use some other services and their cost was like $1 a minute and stuff. You know, if I wanted to do, you know, and I've looked at the quality of the human stuff, I don't think it's as good as the machine stuff. Now, I think the machine stuff is better.
Yeah. You know, I just went through with Raise the Dead. I got human transcripts and, you know, it's a couple $100 by the end of it. And I was actually impressed with how they did. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a little hit and miss where some of them were a little bit better than others.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, I did just through prototyping like a few mechanical ones, and like some were a little janky, but I would love to, if you had a great experience with one, I would love to interact with it.
Yeah, check out Otter. They have an app for the iPhone, probably on Android too, their desktop, whatever. You can upload your files and do that, and they're super proactive. Like every time I mentioned transcription, that the head of product for Otter was interacting with me on Twitter and stuff, and
oh wow,
and he's like, oh, Otter's great for this, but I'm like, well, and I pointed out the thing they can't do is it if I said where are you going? She asked. It won't put that in quotes and do like comma, she asked, you know, question mark, quote, she asked. It won't do that. It doesn't know to do that. So I built a little JavaScript application that would try to do that based on some of my stuff I've done in natural language processing, which I'm going to try to build a couple tools that'll make it easier for authors to use and probably just throw them up on a website. And if people want to import stuff and do that, but you do have to go back there and add that. But I've never had humans do that either, though. So,
yeah,
check it out. That's otter.ai. So, well, let's go ahead and do picks if you guys want.
Yeah, I got a bunch of picks, but I don't know which one to start with. I'll start with this one because I think it was you, Andrew, who told me that this movie was something that I really should see. And I loved it. It spoke to my very soul. It is Dolomite Is My Name on Netflix, starring Eddie Murphy. Just a fantastic cast and a great, great, great let's put on a show story. And a let's make, you know, a man making it in Hollywood when Hollywood wants, in show business, when show business wants absolutely nothing to do with him. It is the true story of Rudy Ray Moore and his Dolomite character and his comedy albums. But man, just fantastic. Eddie Murphy, you watch a role like that and you're like, man, so like 2 decades of costume characters, huh, Eddie? he made a ton of money, so God bless him, but God, is he good here. And so is the rest of the cast.
Nice. Yeah, it is a delightful movie, and I loved Rudy Ray Moore's story because, yeah, he is a guy that, like, he was past the point at which you're supposed to make it. He's past the point at which you're going to be a success. You know, he's middle-aged, bit overweight, whatever, kind of failed at a lot of, had done a bunch of stuff. He'd done a bunch of stuff by then, but then he finally kind of figures sort of this gimmick where he takes, you know, this sort of the sort of subgenre of black humor, you know, based upon kind of, you know, Braggadocio and whatnot, and takes this thing that had been, you know, a very popular kind of joke telling whatever, and realizes that, man, this has never been put on albums. This has never been put in front of people. And there's a large audience for this, not just within the black community, but people in general who, you know, would enjoy this and, you know, become a successful comedian doing, you know, basically, you know, rewriting and taking a kind of different form of humor. And then when he makes the jump to movies and, you know, with a sense of humor, that's hard for people to grasp and realize, no, this is not taking itself too seriously. And it's a neat story. And Wesley Snipes, like, man, like,
so good.
Yeah. He's one of those people that he becomes kind of like when you are away from his performances, he becomes a caricature. But then you go back like at New Jack City, you realize, oh, this guy's amazing. And then he pops up in certain roles and you go, he's so good. He's just so good.
You know, and obviously there is a genre of filmmaking all about artists, right? And about LA and about the movie industry and about making it. This is less that and more of an entrepreneurial kind of story. Yeah. This is not, you know, La La Land or something like that, where it's about the rejections. This is more like finding the true art. This is about, he knows he's right from the first frame. It's him making the world realize that this is something that an audience wants. And it really tells a beautiful story about underserved markets and the fact that people really, really wanted this. And there were a lot of people who are paid a lot of money to say no. That is the story of the movie. But go ahead and check it out. Dolomite Is My Name. It's on Netflix. I hope it gets some award stuff because it is such a delight.
Nice. Yeah. Bryce?
I got a movie pick. I had a really good time going and seeing this. I was unsure. Everyone had told me it was good. It's got a star-studded cast. It is the Rian Johnson written and directed Knives Out. Did either of you guys see this?
Mm-mm.
No, all of my movie consumption was on Netflix this weekend.
Knives Out is really good. It's really, really good. Daniel Craig kind of has one of the more central roles. He plays a consulting detective trying to investigate the apparent suicide of this murder mystery writer. And he's navigating between his, you know, this big family and dealing with inheritance. I won't get into details. Cause, I mean, it's a murder mystery, so there's a lot of, you know, unsolving. Yeah. But it's really great. Daniel Craig's performance is just like angelic. I love him in it. It's so good. And it is not a spoiler to say they could make many more of these movies if they wanted to. There at least the bones to do that are there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really good. I was enthralled in it. I totally lost track of time because it just felt like it was giving you so much. It's fast. It really gets ahead of you, especially if it's doing like a murder. It's doing a murder mystery story, and understanding that people know murder mystery stories and they try to pick at them and figure them out and solve it ahead of time. There's even a point where where Daniel Craig is talking to the other police officers, and he's like, yeah, this is like the house from Clue because it's got all this murder mystery paraphernalia and it's you know, in and around it. It's very, very good. Knives Out, really great movie. Go see it.
I've heard great things about it, and I'm still like, my favorite Rian Johnson film's Brick, you know?
Yeah.
Which, you know, I thought was just a great noir detective story told in high school, and it still holds up. My pick, and man, I'm going to push this on you guys heavily, okay? All right? This is a heavy pick, okay? And not to say, oh, it's so great, but it's so quirky and so much fun and a very charming show that is been below my radar. Like, nobody I know seen it or talked about it, and I read maybe a couple reviews of it that liked it, you know, but then I put it into a category that I realized, no, that's not what this is at all. Any of you guys seen Doom Patrol?
No. That is that on the DC service?
It's on the DC service, which you know, I'm like, you know what? Like, I'm curious to try this show because I knew like Swamp Thing, people like that, but then it didn't get renewed for a second season, which makes you feel a little bit like, I don't know. Doom Patrol is based on the DC characters and tells the story of a group, you know, hey, a group of misfits with superpowers, right? But it's sort of about them doing superhero stuff, but they're all sort of messed up in very different ways, but they're all likable. And the humor in it is so fun and so quirky. Like, at one point, like the town they're near gets vanished, and spoiler alert, it turns out that it's inside of a donkey because it's got an interdimensional gate inside of it, and they have to go inside of the donkey to find the town, kind of thing. But they don't want to do it. They don't want to have to do this sort of thing. You've got the characters in it are really good. I mean, great, you know, great performances by it. And Alan Tudyk plays the sort of the villain who narrates it from time to time, Mr. Nobody, you know, who got his powers from a Nazi scientist in Paraguay. It is. I'm going to pull this up. Just pull up the some of the cast here. The giant robot, the robot guy, is played by Brendan Fraser. Well, he does the voice. So Brendan Fraser, but then Brendan Fraser plays him. You know, Brendan Fraser, the actor, is in flashbacks and stuff where it's him. He was a race car driver, whatever. When the robot's walking around, it's some other guy playing the Cliff Steele character. But you know him. Riley Shinhanan is the guy who does the physical part of it, but it's Brendan Fraser's voice and all that. Diane Guerrero plays his character. She's got 64 different personalities, and some of them have their own superpowers and stuff, but she's totally schizophrenic and crazy. A show that, you know, starts off with somebody going to a Nazi, some low level, you know, low level henchman going to a Nazi scientist to get superpowers and stuff. And then later on, years later, when our heroes show up with this guy's, you know, it is his clinic to find out what's going on. It's explained to them via a puppet show. It's just very, very well done. I was like, I kind of lumped it into with like the CW shows, because some of the people who worked on some of those other like shows were, you know, had been involved in this. It's not that. It is not that at all. It's fun, quirky, offbeat sort of stuff. And like, if you like The Boys, you know, and you like this sort of let's go look at let's go take a superheroes, but let's do something different and fun with it. Yeah, but you see in chat, like Doomsday's really, if it weren't on the DC platform, if it were on Netflix or somewhere else, people would be talking a lot about it.
Huge, yeah.
Yeah. And DC Universe, so this is a DC Universe original, but it also looks like they have like comic books and other series.
So DC Universe launched, which was going to be their big platform for like getting, you know, you could watch all the DC movies. And I think they conceived that when that sounded like that was more exciting of an idea than it is now. Mm-hmm. But they have a ton of stuff, a ton of their movies. They've got the original series they have is the Teen Titans or the Titans TV series, which I've heard mixed things about. The Swamp Thing, which I heard, you know, great stuff about. They've got Krypton on there. They've got a lot of classic stuff. Like they took the old like Shazam series, the kids series, and they actually digitally remastered that.
Wow.
You know, people were asking for that. But there's a lot of stuff on there. And again, it's like, you know, it's $9. You do the trial if you want, but it's like, you know, it's $9 a month. And, you know, it might be a thing. You just try it for a month or two to watch something. But for me, like the Doom Patrol was worth it. You know, I think back and I'm still thinking back in the day where, you know, I would pay $20 for a 2-hour movie DVD, or I would spend $50 for a season of a show. And, you know, that's why I don't get so upset. People are like, all these subscription services. Like, yeah, but I don't buy DVDs anymore. I'm not paying for seasons of shows. I remember like when Star Trek, The Next Generation came out on DVD or like the format it came out, it was like $80 a season or something. Wow. Insane.
That was really, it's like, I mean, the whole idea of Netflix's like binge model comes from the visceral thrill that came from like as DVD box sets and stuff like that had kind of come down in price a little bit, that you could get like season one of Lost for $40, right? Yeah. You know, $40 or $45. Then it was like, oh my God, this is great. This is a thing where $45 and I can watch the whole thing in a weekend. And now, man, we have just come so far from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I remember I had a friend that was a big Star Trek fan, and I think he bought like all of Next Generation, and he spent $1,000, $1,000 to buy that show, where now, like, hey, that'll give you, you know, that's 10 years of Netflix, you know, and gives you all of the stuff and different stuff. And somebody points out, like, you don't own shows anymore. Well, you can still buy them. That option's still there. But we made this trade-off, which was like...
And it's like cheaper now to buy them digitally than, you know, getting DVDs, getting, a you know, four things of DVDs or Blu-rays. Like, even on that side, the price has come down.
Yeah, and services like iTunes, they still let you store copies, you know, on your hard drive and stuff. You know, they have digital certificates, and there's a whole point about like the pros and cons of that. But I like where we are now. I like this universe. I like this universe where some platform said, "Hey, let's invest the money to go digitally remaster Shazam." You know,
I wonder how much or if at all DC Universe will be subsumed into the HBO Max offering that that Warner Brothers is putting together.
Yeah, that's a good question, because like Doom Patrol is a really strong show and you got a second season. I'd hate to see it go away, and if you know, HBO Max maybe, but yeah, I don't, you know, we'll see.
Hey, I'll tell you what, we are in a world now with Disney Plus where you got to come big with your library. The micro libraries I think will exist, of course, for very niche stuff, but even then, when like Netflix is getting into buying up the rights for Korean dramas, you know, and they're starting to cannibalize some of those smaller niche of things, if there is any kind of corporate tie, I see us heading toward a more hegemonic strategy.
I mean, it was maybe in the last month or so. This I don't think this was maybe on your radar, but there was a Stargate subscription service.
And so you
all the episodes and all the movies and stuff. This was in October. They are shutting that service down, giving people refunds for any of their 2020 subscription fees, and are moving some of the stuff, including some of the original series that was going to be on here, to YouTube.
So
with the assumption being that this stuff will get sucked into like whoever aired Stargate or owns the rights to Stargate now.
Well, Yeah, I think it's MGM or, but like, so here's the thing about that. Like, I love Stargate was one of the series that I bought. I had every single, you know, I bought it all on DVD and sort of kind of just kind of came into it kind of late because I just missed it. And then back in the day when I'd work on my magic products and stuff and have to do assembly or play with stuff, I'd just start playing that show and watching it. So they announced they were going to do the standalone Stargate service, which it's like one of those things like, are there that many fans of Stargate right now who are willing to pay $6 a month, $7 a month for it? And answer number one, I thought was no. And two was like, well, we're going to have new content. And they were like 6-minute crappy shows. They were like, they shot like maybe 100 minutes of actual new content for something, you know, featuring characters you never heard of, plot lines you never had, low budget, and then divided up into 6-minute segments. And so you hear like, oh, we're going to have new content, whatever. And then you find out like, yeah, look, like Stargate, like that's just people talking about the show, right? Mm-hmm. That's this the three new shows. Two of them are just we're going to talk about Stargate. Then the other one, which was the one, if you go back and click the one on the left, you're like, oh, looks like a cool new series they have there, Stargate Origins, right?
Oh yeah, this was a big deal. They were saying that this was they were showing this off to be like an original, you know, new fictional story.
Yeah, well, it is. It's 100 minutes of content divided into a bunch of like 6-minute segments.
Wow. It was
10 episodes, right? And each episode was 10 minutes long. So it's 100 minutes.
Oh,
that's what they did.
So they're webisodes.
Yeah. Oh, cool. New Stargate series. Sounds great. Mm-hmm. Well, they're 10 minute longs. It's 100 minutes total.
And,
if you look at the ratings for it.
Yeah. And I think the ask on it was super low. I think it was like $20 for a year or multiple years. Like I do remember the price being rather low and non-recurring. So I guess that, you know, it's not like $12 a month for a Netflix, but still that's not exactly what I thought this thing was going to be.
Was it that I thought it was more than that? I could be mistaken on that.
Well, it doesn't exist anymore, and I agree with Bryce that this is something where, you know, and you know, it's hard to figure this stuff out. But initially, you got to figure, okay, well, where is Stargate best? Is it best sold to somebody else, or if you've got a hardcore contingent of fans, can you make that work? So, what was the price?
So it was a one-time $20 fee. And they did say at the announcement that they would be 10-minute episodes, which I don't know that we got into that much detail of how long these episodes would be when we covered it on Cord Killers 2 years ago. But that's
Yeah, I mean, that's not, I guess the problem is like, you know, a one-time $20 fee. Yeah. But the problem was, it was like, the only original narrative content you got was that 100-minute thing split into 10, you know? And I think other than that, you were getting the behind-the-scenes stuff. And so I think I will give them props for it's an interesting experiment, you know? I think it was an interesting experiment, but clearly their heart wasn't in it because they didn't spend any money on content, you know?
Yeah.
And I would say that's the downside of it. And I think that, you know, you could see how, if Star Trek Discovery wasn't like the way that CBS All Access was one of the big ways they were trying to push that, like you could certainly see how you could do that with maybe like a Star Trek platform or something like that. But anyhow.
Super weird.
Yep. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.